Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. This hour, we're airing highlights from our December Get Lit with All of It book club event. And this was an extra special one. We partnered with the New York Public Library's Roar for NYC initiative, celebrating the resiliency and strength of our great city. So when looking for a book, we wanted to choose something off the library's list of 125 NYC books we love, and we couldn't be happier with our selection, the 1999 classic Motherless Brooklyn by Jonathan Lethem. The story is in some ways a classic whodunit. Frank Minna, a low-level mobster operating on Court Street in Brooklyn, is murdered. One of his underlings, a dedicated amateur sleuth named Lionel, is determined to get to the bottom of what happened to his boss. But here's the catch. Lionel has Tourette's syndrome, which, as you might imagine, makes it a little more difficult to snoop around incognito. As Lionel gets closer to the truth, his investigation takes him all over the city, from Greenpoint to Azendo in Yorkville to a non-operational car service on Smith Street. And his Tourette syndrome actually provides one distinct advantage. People constantly underestimate Lionel to their own peril. Motherless Brooklyn won the 1999 National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction, and it's a book our readers, including the 3,473 of you who checked out the book from the library, really love digging into. And the feeling is mutual. When I spoke to Jonathan for a preview conversation back in December, he told me that he always enjoys revisiting Motherless Brooklyn with readers. So I began this conversation by asking him why Motherless Brooklyn still holds such a special place in his heart.
Well, I mean, it's a feedback loop. It's always been the book of mine that I think has inspired the most, by far the most affection. People want to know Lionel. They want to hang out with Lionel. In fact, sometimes I feel like I'm expected to be as fun as Lionel, and I'm kind of a disappointment to people because I made up somebody who's more lovable, I think, than certainly than myself. And maybe then... the average fictional character. Certainly for me, my characters tend to have a little bit of an edge, be a bit disaffected or alienated or difficult. But Lionel, there's something about him that leans toward the reader. And so the embrace of this character, in my experience, means that people are lit up in a particular way when they want to talk to me about this book. And that's just always been a kind of a treat for me, a kind of nourishment.
It was really fun to read, especially with the idea of this framing of loving New York, because we recognize the streets names and we recognize the Upper East Side. And there's a reference. I went in the Wayback Machine, J&R Music World, where he's getting a cassette for his Walkman. Does the book, when you reread it, I don't know if you reread it recently, is it really, did you mean to make a time capsule?
Well, so the context for my writing Motherless Brooklyn was I'd been living away from New York for my whole young adulthood, all through my 20s. And my first four novels were written in California, and they were all really not about New York. I'd sort of avoided this really prominent main part of my own life and experience. And then in the late 90s, I moved back to New York City and kind of began to fall in love with it and also connect to it in a different way, where I realized how much it formed me and it formed my language and it formed my way of thinking and my personality. So the book is a kind of a mash note. It's a big Valentine upon this return. You know, I was just seeing the streets of Brooklyn with this unbelievably affectionate eye, and I wanted to catalog a lot of what I loved. I wanted to sort of name things for what they were, you know, to talk about the sandwiches and the streets and the language of the streets, the vernacular, and catch some of what meant so much to me.
It was interesting as I stumbled on that one page. I'm stuck on the J&R Music World because it is such of a moment, and I thought, wow, could you have told this story in 2018, or has the internet made that impossible? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? They would have been able to find out everything about the characters.
There's a lot of stuff that's now a historical novel. But that's what, you know, mm-hmm. fiction does, is it freezes contemporary life and you can sort of see how much it's changed. I mean, in a very particular way, of course, the internet and cell phones make writing crime stories really difficult now. A lot of the ways that people are ordinarily like in the dark and looking for clues or wondering whether people are good or bad, you know, now you would just kind of Google them and you can't really be out of contact with people the way you used to be. I think it's really tough for serious writers of mysteries and thrillers, although I'm mm-hmm. I'm really just kind of a, in this book especially, I'm just playing with the form. But the other thing that's changed, and I think it's really changed profoundly, is that people are much more familiar with Tourette syndrome than mm-hmm. they were when I, you know, set out to write it. It was something that could still really surprise you. It had surprised me. I only learned about it a few years before I began researching it, before I became fascinated with it and began researching it for the book. And now some kind of corner was turned and there were a certain number of characters in television shows and movies and, you know, memoirs by people with Tourette's and celebrities with Tourette's who were open about it. And I think it's, you could never write about it quite the way I did, where everyone seems to be learning mm-hmm. about it only because Lionel exists.
We got so many questions about Tourette's and about how you came to it and your experience with it. I'm curious about, from your research, what in your research helped you create Lionel and help create his particular tics?
Well, so the first thing I should explain is that I found out about Tourette's by reading essays by Oliver Sacks. And he's got two different case studies, one in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and another one in a book called An Anthropologist on Mars. And each of these are so compelling to me, and they were so overwhelmingly interesting to me, because there was something about Tourette's, as soon as I learned about it from Sacks' writing, that seemed to reach into me. It seemed to speak to me, which is not the same thing as saying that I was self-diagnosing, because I don't think that anyone would diagnose me as having Tourette syndrome. But there was something about it as a description of a neurological experience, a relationship to language and a kind of reactivity, that I did feel that I was discovering something or considering a description that amplified my sense of myself. And so I did have to research it, and I did everything I could to surround myself with information and description and to meet people with Tourette's and let them talk to me and inform me. But I never would have begun that journey into research if it hadn't also in some sense been a responsive moment for mm-hmm. me, where I felt, oh, there's this, somehow this involves me, even though it doesn't seem to. I'm drawn into a relationship to it that's personal.
We asked our readers, we do these Instagram questions out. All right, we asked our readers how they thought Lionel's Tourette's enhanced or complicated this detective story. One person wrote to say, quote, it added verbal texture to the narration. Another wrote, readers and characters trust him because they think he has no choice but to speak his mind. How do you think Tourette's helps Lionel as a detective?
I like that. I like both of those descriptions very much. And that last one, the sense that he's almost wearing his brain on the outside, that anyone can meet him and sort of experience what he's thinking. You know, one of the origin points for my notion of putting Tourette's together with the traditional hard-boiled detective story was that I, as a great fan of, you know, Humphrey Bogart movies and Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler and Ross MacDonald, it seemed to me that the signature characteristic of the hard-boiled detective is their verbal mastery. You know, this is a character who's mm-hmm. In the dark. They don't know what the plot is. There are invisible forces. They're outgunned and outnumbered by both the police and the criminals, and they tend to exist in a space somewhere between those two. But the one thing they have, and this is very typical of Bogart's portrayal of the hard-boiled detective in The Big Sleep and Maltese Falcon, is that they walk into any given room and they kind of run verbal rings around the other characters. They have command. Mm-hmm. Their wisecracks and their interrogation and their sarcasm, you know, that's what makes them who they are. And in a way, that's what it is to be hard-boiled. And so the idea of a character who was the almost the ultimate opposite of this, it was like a soft-boiled detective. He had no verbal control. He was almost at the mercy of language in every situation and in every scene. It struck me as a very funny idea, and also one that would make the mechanics of the detective story really visible in an interesting way. You would see how the idea of this character entering a room and interrogating or trying to learn things or trying to command the people around them really operated.
I have to ask you about how you came up with the string of words that would be in Lionel's tics, because I kept marking which ones I liked, and there was one when he and Tony are talking about, and Tony's talking about Batman, and Batman always gets away, the supervillain will never learn, and Lionel says, "Uncle Batman," I shouted. "That couldn't know how much work it was for me to keep my hands on the dashboard, my neck straight." This is one just made, "Uncle Bailey, Blackman, Barnum, Batmanopotamus."
Thank you. I'd forgotten that one.
How did you, when you were trying to develop those strings, because they make sense.
Well, I hope that they all are doing productive work as well as being absurd and surreal. You know, one of the things that I loved growing up was overt nonsense. Lewis Carroll and the poems of people like Edward Lear and I love Dr. Seuss, and I, you know, memorized some of my favorite Dr. Seuss books. And there are those like On Beyond Zebra, where they go past just unexpected combinations of the English language and into, in a sense, a kind of new language, an invented language, which is also what Lewis Carroll does, like in a poem mm-hmm. like The Jabberwock. And I think that and of course, these things point towards, you know, some kind of high literature. It's like, you know, if you're on the road through Lewis Carroll, eventually you're going to end up at James Joyce. But I was never quite as exalted as that. I kind of wanted to have my regular storytelling and my nonsense at the same time. And so I loved to invent characters who would sort of represent the principle of the absurd and would speak in a crazy way. If you look at the books that precede Motherless Brooklyn, there tends to be some small part, some walk-on, some minor character, or small group of characters who kind of keep alive this spirit of nonsense. And in a way, Motherless Brooklyn was just me calling my own bluff and saying, what if I, you know, instead of putting this character at the margins, what if I made that nonsense talker into the narrator of the book? What if I put them in charge of the entire language system? And, you know, it was a chance to play. What you hear, you know, what you're reading aloud to me is the sound of me playing and having fun. It was a gas to write the book. But I did have to subject them in revision to the pressure to make them all meaningful. You know, it was in a sense, it was easy to smash syllables together. What was difficult was to resolve them in a way that generated narrative meaning. And I tried my best to make them all meet that test.
Before we leave the subject, we did get this question from several people. Jonathan, have you received any feedback from people with Tourette's?
Oh, sure. I mean, it was an enormous part of my life for the years just following publishing this book, and a really rewarding experience. I wrote it relatively incognito, although I did, thanks to incredible luck, I became acquainted with Oliver Sacks, and he introduced me to a couple of really eloquent and charming and marvelous friends of his, because they weren't really his patients. They were just people with very interesting and overt cases of Tourette's who Oliver was interested in. And one in particular named Shane Fistel in Toronto, I spent some time with, and he wasn't so much the model for Lionel as he was my weather vane. He was his reactivity and the amount of language and behavior that he generated was so extraordinary, and he was so unembarrassed about it. He was so, in a way, interested in, and you know, he saw it as his self-definition. So he gave me a lot of permission just by his existence. But I mostly, you know, I mostly learned by reading things. And it was after the book was published that I began to be, I found my life in a way surrounded by the Tourette's community, because I'm grateful to say I'd done at least enough, even if I made some exaggerations or distortions, I'd done enough to clarify the one thing that they are most adamant about. And this is less a problem now because people are more well-informed, but it was in the 20th century, a big problem was that it was mistaken for a form of emotional disorder, of a kind of madness, when in fact it's a pure neurological dysfunction. And since I'd specified that so carefully, the community of people within Tourette's advocacy, which consists not only of the people who suffer Tourette's, but their families, often the parents are the drivers of the Tourette's advocacy community. They kind of swept me up. They were like, okay, we like your book, so now you got to come do some work for us. So I spent a couple of years going to a lot of conferences and sitting on panels, and often I would be the one person in a room full of people who had an urgent and heartrending reason to be there. They'd grown up with Tourette's, or they'd raised a child with Tourette's, and they were educating others, and they were also doing outreach to other people who were in this situation, who felt isolated. And I became kind of ally. Yes, an ally or a kind of spirit animal. I was like a friend of the Tourette's world for a while, which was incredibly rewarding for me. Mostly, I didn't talk; I listened, because I'd already exhausted my real knowledge about their world in the book. And so everything I learned subsequently, I almost could have written another book about that experience.
Let me ask you about some of the relationships in the book, Motherless Brooklyn, specifically between Minna and Lionel. Minna scooped up these boys, these Minna men from an orphanage, but there seems to be a truly, really special relationship between Lionel and Minna. And we asked our readers what they thought, if they thought Minna, despite him not being who he said he was, that Minna, had he ultimately been a positive influence on Lionel's life? And 68% said yes, 32% said no. That's a lot of yes, considering Minna brought Lionel into a life of organized crime. What do you think? Was Minna good for
Lionel? I love the question. I love that we have like an actual voting tally. I'm on the yes team. I think that the thing about Minna is he's a permission to be character. He has a strange effect where he lets other human beings exist, and that he did this for Lionel, who needed it, I guess you'd say, more badly than most of us, although we all need this permission to be. And for that, as much as Frank Minna is obviously, yes, a criminal, and also he's not exactly politically correct, he's a chaotic character and a self-destructive character, there's something about him that's lovely to me, and so I would probably vote with the majority on that one.
Well, if you like numbers, I have more numbers for you. Let's talk about Julia and the women in the novel. We asked our readers about halfway through, people who are reading Mother's Brooklyn, where they thought Julia had something to do with her husband's death. 33% thought she was involved. 67% said she was a red herring. So we meet her early in the novel, and then we don't hear from her again. Yeah. Was that always the choice?
You know, I'm going to have to plead improvisation. And I was learning what my story was as I wrote it. Mm-hmm. And I was still five novels in learning how to tell stories. And I think that probably there's something a little lopsided that you're detecting in that query. And as I recall, I think my feeling about Julia was that she was a victim, not a perpetrator, and that you know, what I wanted to do with that character was, in a way, raise the specter of the most problematic, for me, part of traditional film noir or hard-boiled detective fiction, which is that there tends to be a femme fatale. You know, it often all gets pinned on the woman in the end of the story. And I thought what was interesting to me, but maybe is somewhat incomplete, it didn't become the center of this story, but the thought I was having about the femme fatale was that Julia herself had mistaken herself for one but wasn't one. Mm. That she wasn't part of the plot. She didn't have a lot of power, but she'd been cast by circumstance, tradition, by the figure she cuts as she moves through this world. She'd been cast in the role of the femme fatale and, in a sense, had drunk some of the Kool-Aid herself on that. She was one of the people who'd kind of fallen for that red herring, along with the reader.
That was my conversation with author Jonathan Lethem from our December Get Lit with All of It book club event. We spent the month reading his 1999 novel, Motherless Brooklyn.